I apologize for these things. I understand that these aren't supposed to be up here, but I thought they did go with the carpet, so. I did, yeah, well, thanks, bro. You guys doing all right tonight? Yeah, it's good to see you out tonight. You could be out doing anything, but you decided to come here, and I hope you're ready to listen. I want to try to say some things tonight, talk about one of the first shifts that have to take place in our lives. We're kind of processing this in our church. Our whole staff has taken this on, and this is a conservative Christian school, so you'll appreciate this. We were saying, you know, we really have no control over the soul. There's things that we can do to control the climate, but we can't really control the soul itself. Only God can do that. That these shifts are not something we can make happen. They just happen to us. And all of a sudden, one staff member piped up and said, shift happens. And so the next day, one of our staff went out and one night got t-shirts made that say, shift happens at College Church. It wasn't quite. Now, some of you are looking like you're not getting it. It's probably a good thing that you don't get it, you know? That's good. That's good. But it's just kind of an awkward way to introduce your church to somebody, to say this is a place where shifts happen. But actually, we hope it is. We hope it becomes a community, because one of the things I'm learning about us is that all of us change according to community. We really do. We like to think that we pick our friends according to who we are, but actually, we become like our friends. They shape us in subtle ways. And so community is a powerful thing, and it's part of what I want to talk to you about tonight. But let me just kind of recap what we said. Each one of us has a soul, not has a soul, is a soul. And that soul is hard to get hold of. You can't look at it anytime you want. Only God can show you the soul. And when he does, that's the time to do something about it. That's the time to actually make changes. And so what we've done is we're looking at this process of transformation. How do people change? Because, I mean, I think we're noticing the same thing that you've noticed, is that people have become Christians, but then they never really changed. They got sanctified, but then they never really changed. And what we wanted was people that were authentically different. And I quoted it this morning, but one of the statements that just rattled me was a statement by A.W. Tozer in his chapter on the use of good books, where he said, "I do not care to hear the books that you've read. I want to see the effect of them." Now, you can translate that to just about anything, can't you? You can say, "I don't care what your degree is. I want to see the effect of that degree." And that's a pretty loud thing to say at a university who hands out degrees, who believes, because they should, that most of life can be reasonable. That the educating of a person actually changes the person, when in fact, it doesn't. It opens up opportunities to you that you would never have if you weren't educated. So I hope you get not only your bachelor's, but even more than that. But clearly, education alone cannot change the nature of a person, can it? That has to happen deep inside of a person at a level that the person himself can't even touch. And when it does, all of life is different. One of the thoughts that have jarred me lately is that we don't really need more Christians in the world to reach the world for Christ. Now, don't bite back. Just wait. We should win more people to Christ. We need to do this. And so I have friends, I have neighbors that are close, and we're trying to walk them to that place. One of them just discovered that God is three instead of one. "Who's this Holy Spirit guy?" she says. So, I mean, she's getting there, right? But we don't need to do that in order to convert the world. Because the problem with our culture right now, with Wilmore, Lexington, is not that there are too few Christians. There are plenty of Christians to make a difference. The trouble is getting the people who are already Christians to act like it. That would change the world, right? I mean, we know from Malcolm Gladwell's research in The Tipping Point that it only takes 10% to tip a culture. In the height of its dynasty, only 7% of the Soviet Union was card-carrying communists. 7%. And yet the entire country was communist. It just so happens that those 7% were really influential people. You know? But again, we're not talking about having to win everybody to Jesus. We'd love to do that. But even if we can't, if we could get the people that we've already won to go off to the teacher's lounge and on break talk about the principle as though they were Christians, that would be a big shift. Right? If we could get people on the floor in General Motors who were respecting the authority over them because their Christian morals said you respect authority, you submit when you're not in charge, that would be such a significant shift if we could get Christians to not watch television shows, you know, or movies. You wouldn't need to boycott or preach against it and all that other junk that we do. It would literally change the culture. And we have, what, 40, 42% of us right now in most communities that say they're born-again Christians, and they go to church regularly. So the question is not how do we get more people saved. The question is how do we get saved people converted? How do we get people who said the prayer to actually be transformed with ever-increasing likeness? Are you with me so far? Yeah? This is a good time to go, yeah. Yeah, thanks, you guys. So we lined out some shifts. What would it be to shift from this kind of a person that you were born with and into a completely different kind of person? And tonight I want to talk about one of the shifts that I hope you will join me in, and I'll be right up front about it. The shift is a shift from sheep to shepherds. Deep inside of you is a soul. And when you come to Jesus Christ, you begin to follow Jesus. But something fundamental and life-altering happens to you when one day you wake up and it occurs to you that you and Jesus are in charge of the world. Really? Okay, take a moment, look around. Look around. This is who's in charge of the world. Yeah, I know. I know. I'm like, holy cow. But it is. I mean, it occurs to you. I mean, has it occurred to you that if Jesus came to save the world all by himself, he left too soon? There were as many thieves and hookers on the day he left as there was on the day he came. Maybe what he was doing was he was coming to earth and he was investing himself in people. And the people were in charge of the spiritual climate wherever they live. And all of a sudden, I mean, some time ago that dawned on me. I thought, wait a minute. I am part of God's plan to actually redeem the world. I mean, here all this time I've been waiting for Tim LaHaye's rapture. And what if that doesn't happen? I mean, what if God says, you're there, I'm with you, change the world. And on that day, something deep inside of me that nobody noticed began to happen. I remember the day. I walked off of the beach. I was reading a book. I walked off the beach. My wife was inside the cottage. And I said to her, I said, holy cow, we got problems. And she goes, who, you and me? I said, no. The church. We got big issues in the church. And she's like, come on, man, you can't take that on. Just pastor the church and go to bed. And And you couldn't. All of a sudden, something inside me just began to grow. And I think, wait a second. Jesus is investing himself inside of us. He's multiplying himself in us. We are together what he was alone. We can do this. This kind of sounds like Obama, doesn't it? Yes, we can. But that was a fundamental shift for me, you guys. And so I'll be right up front with you. We need you. I mean, we need you. We need teachers and artists and musicians and economists and educators and politicians. We need housewives. We need stay-at-home dads. We need contractors. We need coaches, and we need some athletes. We need writers. We need people who can live out this gospel in 1,000 different ways so that gradually we begin to see the kingdom of God come alive. That's what we, and when that happens, you get it. Now, of course, the way to do this is not to just run back to your dorm and say, okay, I'm in charge, sit down. That probably won't work very well. Okay, but keep in mind, something has to happen that you in that shift, you have to say, God is asking me to worry about the spiritual climate of my sphere of influence. Does that make sense? That's either my circles or my team, it's my dorm, it's my friends, it's my family, whatever it is. There's a circle of people around me, and God is telling me that he wants me to worry about that. Doesn't say I got to preach to them, I have to have an altar call, none of that stuff. But I have to worry about that, about somebody else's spiritual life. Now, again, the way to do this is not to run off and say, now, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to start leading a choir. I'm going to play the piano in next chapel service. My guess is if you can't play the piano, that might not go very well. And so I went to Jesus's life. I thought, if we want to learn how Jesus did this, how did he do it? As Dallas Willard says, Jesus was not only God, he was also really, really smart. I thought he would know something about sheep to shepherd. The call to follow is a call to enlist. There is no two-tiered. The call to be a disciple is a call to lead. So how did Jesus do it? And I found in Luke chapter 6, I want to read a few verses to you because it's right here. It says in Luke that Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray. He spent the whole night praying to God. When morning came, he called his disciples to him, and he chose 12 of them, whom he designated apostles. And then in Luke 6, 14 through 16, it lists the 12 disciples. Jesus went down with them and stood on a level place. A large crowd of disciples was there, and a great number of people from all over Judea, from Jerusalem and from the coast of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. Those troubled by spirits were cured, and the people all tried to touch him because power was coming out from them and was healing them. There's like three disciplines in this. Do you hear them? I'll just give them to you. There is the discipline of solitude, there's the discipline of community, and then there's the discipline of ministry. Let's get it straight again. There's the discipline of solitude. It says, morning came, Jesus went out to a mountainside by himself, and he sat down and prayed. And then it went from solitude into community. After he did that, he called his disciples around him, and he started to name the 12. And then after he called the disciples around him and he had the community, he went into ministry. It said he went down and stood on a level place, and people came from all over to hear him, and they were healed of their diseases. And if they had evil spirits, they were cast out. So I look at these three components of what it means to shift from being a follower of Jesus to being a leader with Jesus. One of them is solitude. One of them's community, one of them's ministry. One more time, one of them's solitude, the second one is, yep, and the third one is, ministry. That's right. Now, here's the deal. Every one of you are good at one of these things by nature. Some of you love solitude. I do. I'm an introvert by nature, believe it or not. When I'm not here, I love quiet, lonely places, you know? And some of you artsy people are that way. You're like, wait, I gotta go think. You know? What's up with that? Hey, I sense a poem coming on. Wait, you know? And we don't know whether that's a poem or last night's pizza, but you feel something stirring inside of you, and you got, yeah, and so, and that's not a bad thing, but you just love it. The only problem with the world are other people. But if you love solitude as I do, and then, by the way, you love to move right from solitude. You're in an office writing all these deep, profound thoughts. Even God's going, wow, how'd you think of that? You know, you're writing all these thoughts and you're going, wow, this sucker's gonna rock. Then you get up here in the pulpit and you just want to go right into ministry, but you leave out community. Your solitude becomes septic. It becomes ingrown. And your world starts to shrink. Some of you are the opposite. You love community. You know, the only problem with school are the classes. You know? It's true, isn't it? It's like, man, what do we have to actually do stuff for? Why can't we just get together, hold hands and sing Kumbaya or something like that? You know, it's like one fellow said, instead of math answers, why don't they just have impressions in math? And if you get a different impression than me, hey, can't we all be friends? You know, that's your style. You love that way. The problem is if you don't include solitude, then your community becomes shallow. And your activity becomes frenetic, disjointed, all over the place. You just run from one event to the other because you're not centered inside. Does that make sense? And some of you just love ministry. It's a lot of the preachers in this thing. They're just like, oh, none of this matters. Just let God fill you and go lead. They think, well, yeah, whatever. Yeah, I'm glad my heart surgeon's not thinking that way. I'm glad he prepares. But if you don't, in ministry, whatever you do, if you don't like solitude and you don't like community, then your ministry, your lectures in the classroom, your sermons in the pulpit, your performance in the band or whatever you're doing, your ministry will become narrow. Your world will shrink. You will become condescending on other people because you're never with other people. You're always in front of other people. And you know the saying, if you want to hide, find a stage. Now here's the deal. Every one of these three things has an obstacle. There's something in our community, in our world right now, that stops us from getting very good at these things. And if we can bust through those things, God will open up to us a whole life of a shepherd that we've never dreamed of before. Take, for instance, solitude. Right from the very beginning, we know two things about Jesus. One is that wherever he went, he attracted a crowd. Two is that he avoided them, you know, whenever he could. I mean, it says in Luke chapter 5:16, but Jesus frequently withdrew to lonely places and prayed. And, you know, aside from the fact that Jesus was the Son of God, which you have to admit is a pretty big advantage, aside from that, in my understanding, it was probably there when he was alone and quiet and prayed that was the secret to his success. That was the secret to his success. Everybody that you know who has ever influenced you, whether it's a rock band or an artist or whether it's a speaker or an author, whatever it is, they probably got the idea for whatever impressed you in solitude. They didn't get it swapping emails. One of the things that we lack in our culture today is the gift of solitude. We do not know how to be alone. The challenge, the ceiling, the obstacle for solitude is speed. It's fast. And by fast, I don't mean the pace of life. I mean the philosophy of life. Fast is a way of life. It's not just a speed. Fast is hurried, controlling, urgent, frenetic, domineering. Fast is moving from one thing to the next because you can't absorb the moment. I don't know about you, but I hate to wait. I was not gifted with patience. I hear it's a great virtue, but I figure we'll have forever to wait after we die. Now is the time. And so, I mean, I'll typically do the kind of what the John Ortberg says. You pull up to a stoplight with two lanes and you're not sure which lane to get in. You look at the two cars and based upon the make of the car, the year of the car, and the age of the driver, you get in that lane. You, in the shopping market, he says, you find yourself going through the checkout and there are shopping carts and you end up counting the number of objects in the carts, timesing by the number of people in the line, and then you pick the line that you're going to go in. This is true. I will go into a fast food restaurant, say Burger King, and I'll pull up and the cars are lined around the back. And do you guys do this? And you look and you look inside and then you look at the line, the cars, and you go, "Nah, I think it's faster if I just go in." And so I will mark the last car in the line going around, a blue Toyota. And because that way I know if I beat it or not, right? And so you get, yeah. And I'm thinking, as long as I get out before the blue Toyota, then I'm making time today. Now, my friend Todd Voss is even worse. He sends his wife into the restaurant. He stays in the car. I'm not making this up. And while she's in the restaurant, he's inching closer. And if he gets to the drive-thru before she calls him, he calls her on the cell phone. And he's like, "Quit, abort, 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 get out." Dude, you are sick if you do this. And you know how it is, if you get out on time, you're like, "Man, life is so good." But if you get out behind the blue Toyota, you're like, "Man, the gods are angry at me today." You know, we are driven for speed. And what I've noticed is that when I live fast like this, I live more shallow. I notice that I see more people, but I meet fewer of them. And when I start to get shallow, sin is more tempting to me than it was before. God is trying to teach me. Learn to be still. Turn off the computer. You don't have to get emails first thing in the morning. I mean, I literally will say, if I start doing emails, the rest of the morning is shot. Turn off the iPod. Take it out of the ears. Turn off the cell phones. I don't have to text all of the time. Learn to be in a room with no one but God and your thoughts. And for a long period of time, soak in that. Fred Craddock says, "Everyone who has influenced us has spoken words that had their context in silence." Silence. Mother Teresa and Tom Brokaw, a few years ago, had an interview. Tom Brokaw said to Mother Teresa, "So, do you talk to God?" She goes, "Yes." "Well, what does God say to you?" She said, "Nothing." "Well, then what do you say to God?" He said, or Mother Teresa said, "Nothing." "Well," Mr. Brokaw says, "wait a minute. You say you talk to God, but you don't say anything to him, and he doesn't say anything to you." "That's right." "I don't get that," said Brokaw. Mother Teresa said, "Mr. Brokaw, if you don't get it, I can't explain it to you." learn to be still. Second is community. Right after Jesus was alone, he moved into circles with community. Now, people in the religion department like to tell us that he got disciples around him because he was making disciples. He was starting a church. He was investing in others. But all that sounds too utilitarian to me, like Jesus was some shrewd businessman. I think Jesus hung around with other people because he liked them. Isn't that scientific? I mean, Jesus did say, I call you friends. And I think when you like people, you go there because you can't stay away. I mean, I think Jesus came to earth with a mission, but I think one of the reasons he came to earth was because if you love people, you have to be with them. They're not your pity case. Even if they're not like you, you still have to be with them. I have family that live in Michigan. They're like Philistines. But, you know, but they're family, right? And when we're there, we're with them. Because that's what love does. And when you love people, you are in that community. Now, the obstacle to community, of course, or one of them, is technology. We have Facebook and text messages and emails and cell phones and my goodness. And the problem with this, of course, is that the technology, you can't talk about the deeper things in that medium. Emails is not the medium to communicate the deepest thoughts of a person. It takes a face-to-face encounter. But the real challenge to community is fear. I don't blend with my community because I'm afraid of people. I'm afraid that they're going to find something out about me that they're not going to like. And so when I'm afraid, I don't open up. And when I'm afraid, I get critical of other people because I think other people are being critical of me. And so when I'm critical of you, it's sort of like a preemptive strike. You know what I mean? Man, I know you're going to bash me. Bam, there, it's over with. And fear can drive you crazy. When I moved to Marion, I went into a house that the guy who lived there before, he got lost his job. He got booted out. And I remember sitting around looking at the house, whether we were going to buy it or not. And I said, where's the previous owner? And they said, it didn't work out for him. He's no longer here. And so while my kids went looking through the house, I remember sitting by the fireplace and looking out over the yard and thinking to myself, dear God, don't let that happen to me. The last thing I want is to uproot my family, bring them to Marion, and all of a sudden it doesn't work out for Dad. Huh? Dad couldn't get along with people. Oh God, don't let that happen to me. And so you know what? When I finally landed at College Church, I worked like a fiend. I called it ministry, you know, pouring my lives into others. It wasn't ministry. It was fear. I was afraid of failing. And because I was afraid, I worked like a maniac. I just called it something else. Fear will do funny things to you. When you're afraid, you get divisive. Polarize. And of course, the way to fix this is not to go to the student center and everybody have a frappe. The way to fix this is to be alone. Believe it or not, you have to be alone. Because what happens is, until a person knows who they are with God alone, What we'll do is we'll look to other people in our communities to try to fill that void. We expect our friends to say things and be things and do things for us that only God can do. We want them to say, you're good, I like you, you're special, you are valuable. But you understand, people can't say that in the way that God can say it. And God doesn't say that in community. He says it alone. So when I am alone with God, I learn who God is for me. And then I am free to go into a community and be who God has made me to be. And that's where the beauty is. I don't have to live to please other people. I can just be who I was made to be. And some of them like it. Greg Louganis was a diver when I was a young man. And he was in the U.S. Olympic team. He stood at the end of a diving board. Some of you remember, your parents do, in Seoul, Korea. He had one dive left. He needed perfect tens. He walked out to the end of the board like this for his final high dive. And we all thought, there is no way, because the Russians are judges. And he got ready to dive, and he left the board, turned a few times, and he entered the water so perfectly that the water just opened up. Just sort of went, ooh, and was over. And we went, oh my goodness. Oh, that's right, the Russians are judging this. And all of a sudden they showed the score. And the score, believe it or not, unprecedented, perfect tens, gold medal. A few months after that, I remember seeing an interview with Greg Louganis on a talk show. And they said, you're standing at the end of the board. What are you thinking to yourself? You got to stick this. He says, I remember before I left the board, I said to myself, Greg, it doesn't matter what you do. Your mother will still love you. I got to tell you that. It doesn't matter what you do in your classes. Your profs care. I don't. Your father will still love you. It does not matter whether you are attractive or not. Your father loves you. You may have real serious limitations intellectually. Maybe not, but maybe. Your father loves you. And the only way to hear that is to get alone with God and let him say it. And then when he does, you can go into a community and be free. Last piece is ministry. God will call you to be alone. You must learn to be still. And then God will call you into a community. You must learn to be with a trusted, small group of friends. And then God will call you into ministry. And the obstacle to ministry is agendas, schedules, deadlines. We'll map out our lives. This is college, you know. Nobody's ever just hanging at college. You're always headed from one class to the next, or from the next appointment. You got a paper due, and then there's a convocation, and then you got to do a project, and then some professor wants this, and then my advisor wants to meet with me, you know? And in the middle of all of this back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, your life is so scheduled. Sometimes we fail to see God is dropping in front of us opportunities that don't fit the schedule, but they're there. And the best opportunities for ministry do not come in planned events like chapel. They come in casual conversations afterwards. I'm not the preacher. You are. Some time ago, I was called to speak in North Carolina. It was a one-night shot. They said, there's a district conference. We're going to fly you down. You preach one night. You get on the plane and you go home. I was petrified. Because they don't call you down there to preach, you know, a B-plus sermon. They want an A. They want a home run. People, I don't have one of those. And so I'm thinking, oh, man, I got to write this whole sucker now. So I sat down and I wrote this message. I got it all planned out. I'm going to say this, 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 and this to all of these pastors, right? And the lay people. And so I thought, I'm going to get there. I got the sermon done. I was proud of it. On my way out the door, I grabbed four other ones, you know, just in case. And put them in my bag. And I ran off, got in the plane, flew down there, waited at the airport. Nobody picks me up. I called 11 different people before I found somebody. And they said, oh, we're not supposed to pick you up. You're supposed to rent a car and drive. So I rented a car. And before I left, I said, how far is the place? They said, hour and a half. What time does it start? 7:00. What time is it? 5:30. Do the math. I'm in my jeans. Don't say anything. I rent the cheapest car I can. I get a little Ford Escort. Look at this body in a Ford Escort. I get in the Escort, I get off onto the interstate, and I am just ripping. And all of a sudden, it's a parking lot. Everything is shut down. There's a gazillion cars out there, and I can't get anywhere. I'm calling back at the office and saying, find alternate routes, you know. And they said, we don't know how to get there. I'm finally getting into an open flat. I'm going 80 miles an hour in a little four banger Escort. Just that car's just going, you know, and I've got my notes up on the wheel like this. I guess people are driving by going, wow. And finally, we pull into the parking lot. I have my suit coat and everything in my hands and my briefcase and my Bible like this. And I'm going running into the conference center at 5 till 7. I was driving by grace, not law. And as I went in there, people were walking in and they were saying like, well, who are you? And I said, you'll know in 5 minutes. So I went into the men's bathroom, the big handicap stall, and I got in there and I got on the cell phone and I'm changing my clothes and I'm calling my wife and I'm saying, man, you got to pray. I am so dead all the way down here, traffic, and no one picks me up. What kind of a half-baked system is this anyway? You know, things that Jesus would say. Yeah, right. And she said, okay, we'll pray, we'll pray. They come and grab me and say, got to do a sound check. So they bring you back out there, kind of half-dressed, putting your stuff on. Okay, get up, do a sound check. And all of a sudden, now go sit down here. It's time for church. And he walks over and he says, after the choir's done, you're up. Okay, fine. I'm collecting my thoughts, trying to get everything together again. And I'm sitting there, you guys, and I kid you not, in the middle of that choir song, I have a strong sense of God, of God's voice. I know what that feels like. And he just said, you know that message that you wrote? You can't do that. I was so shocked by this, I said right out loud, you got to be kidding me. Like this. There's like people two rows behind me are going. I'm going, oh, be quiet. You're just mad the voices aren't talking to you. So now I'm like rifling through my bag. Oh, no, what am I going to do? I finally, I reach in, I grab this sermon. I haven't seen that thing in probably 6 months. And I pull it out, and they say, and the choir's all done now. And now it's me to walk up on this thing. And I'm just opening this thing. I kid you not. I'm walking up the side of the steps like this. I got this thing open, and I'm going. Really good to be with you tonight, you guys. Hey, they're thinking you lie. I was lying through my teeth. I preached this sermon on what it was to be a disciple. Don't remember what I said. And then at the very end, I just remember I needed an illustration. I told an old thing that I'd had before. And I said, you know what? Here's the bottom line. If whatever God is saying to you tonight, just say yes. Just say yes. I mean, it's not a lot, I admit that, but I was emptying my pockets at that point. Any thought I'd had in the last 6 months, I was just putting them out there. I was done. One of our generals was right there, and I just said, you know what? We're just going to pray. Father, thanks for this hour. Basically, see you later. And I went off the side of the platform, and the service was over with. I got in my car. I drove back. My secretary called and said, how did it go? I said, I have no idea. I got up, I did what I think God told me to do. She said, what? Yeah, he told me to do that. Well, did it work? I said, I have no idea. She said, did he confirm it? I said, no. Do you believe that? He tells me to change it and then does not have the decency to say that was good. I have no idea how this went. I mean, you like a little affirmation, you know what I mean? 2 years later, I'm teaching at an event, training ministers. 55-year-old man walks up. His name is Bate Garman. Lives in North Carolina. He says, you know what? 2 years ago, you came to our conference. You remember that night? I said, oh, like yesterday. He said, you know, you preached a sermon on discipleship, and you finished by saying, whatever God is telling you to do, just say yes. Do you remember that? I said, yes. He said, you know, you never gave an altar call. I said, I couldn't wait to get out of there. He said, these are his words. He said, Steve, I was knocking chairs over in the back to get down to the front and pray. He's an engineer, making a lot of money. I'd been fighting a call, he said, for years. And that night, God's Spirit said, just say yes. And he said, I came down and I knelt and I want to be a preacher. And that's why I'm in the class. Bake is now, on this day, a preacher in North Carolina in the Wesleyan Church. I say that to say this. You never know. Whatever you're doing right now, it may feel like it has no difference in the world. It may feel like nobody's listening to you. Those term papers may seem completely useless to you, but you never know. It may seem that the talent that you have is too small and that the world is too big, but you never know. 1700, an artist named Sternberg was commissioned to paint a crucifixion of Jesus for the St. Jerome Church. Sternberg was not a believer. He painted the painting half done, set it in the corner, went out and hired a gypsy girl to paint her. When the gypsy came into the studio and posed for Sternberg to paint her, she glanced over at a half-finished portrait of Christ on the cross and said, "Who is that man?" Sternberg said, "It's Jesus, Christian figure." Over the next few visits, the gypsy kept asking him, "Why did they do that to him? What did he do to them? Why did they crucify him?" And Sternberg tried the best that he could to finish the story. But on the last day she was there, the gypsy said to him, "Listen to this. You must love him very much if he did that for you." Sternberg did not believe he did that for him. But after the woman left, he decided, in his words, "There is no feeling in the painting." He studied the life of Jesus Christ and, in the process of studying him, converted to Christianity. Then he finished the portrait of Jesus on a cross. The portrait was hung in the St. Jerome Church. Some years later, a fellow walked in front of it by the name of Nicholas Count von Zinzendorf, looked at the painting, knelt down in front of it, and said, "I will give my life to that." Got up and started what is known as the Moravian Movement, which influenced a fellow you might have heard of, John Wesley. The painting was then taken out of the St. Jerome Church and was put inside of a museum. About 100 years after it was painted, a young lady was walking through the museum one day. She stopped in front of the painting, looked at it, knelt down in front of it, got up, went to her pastor and said, "I will never be the same." Picked up a pen and begin to write, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." You know the name as Francis Ridley Havergal. Who would have thought that a half-finished painting would lead to the movements in the holiness history the way that that one does? But you never know. Whatever you have in your hand, however insignificant you feel, if you give it to God in ministry, you never know.